The streetlights come on, it's getting dark. She's supposed to be home before the streetlights come on. She wasn't home yet, so I'm thinking she's just out there playing with a friend. She never came home.
She should be playing with a friend. She should be going to school and enjoying herself. Not strangled, murdered, and treated like a piece of garbage.
Seeing her laying there smoldering is tore you up. It's one of those cases that never leave you. And Stanley's making sure of that.
There's no doubt whatsoever in my mind or heart that they have the right man.
He looked at and or processed 10,000 items of evidence and never found anything that connected Jennifer and Stanley.
I mean, I like cheese, but I'm not a rat. I like kids, but not like that.
You're listening to Suspect Convictions, a podcast from WVIK and Scott Reeder. I'm Lacey Scarmana. This week, Scott Reeder sat down with a panel of guests to talk about the Stanley Liggins case. He was joined by former Scott County Attorney Bill Davis, who prosecuted Stanley Liggins' first two trials, Stanley Liggins' second defense attorney Mike Toby, and Aphrodite Jones, the New York Times best-selling author of Cruel Sacrifice and host of the television show True Crime with Aphrodite Jones. Here's their conversation.
One of the questions that comes to my mind, Mike, is... When we've talked in the past, you said you think that Joe Glenn, Jennifer's stepfather, was somehow involved in the murder. Could you explain why you think that?
Well, I do think that it's at least plausible that he was involved in it. And there's not much good you can say for Ace, his nickname. It's just one of those circumstances where... It's just a plausible thing to believe what I have suggested, anyway, that he is likely to have handed her over to people of whom he was afraid and indebted, to whom he was indebted as anything. So, you know, I don't have any hardcore evidence. Primarily circumstantial evidence. His accessibility, his personality, his weaknesses, and his kind of cover Ace's ass no matter what it takes lifestyle.
You said when we talked earlier that you had a very odd experience when you were cross-examining Ace in the courthouse in Dubuque. Where some men came into the courtroom during the cross-examination?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
They were two very large, by that I'd say 6'4", maybe even a little more than that. And both of them had very liberal and I'd say unusual tattoos on their faces. And... They came in approximately halfway through Bill's direct exam, and they left immediately after my cross-exam. And, to me, they were exactly the kind of people by look, anyway, who would have been involved in the drug business as well as being violent enough to have participated in the death of a little girl the way she died.
I guess one of the questions that comes to mind on that, Mike, is, I mean, why do you think they were there?
I think they were there to intimidate and to make sure they knew what was said.
That begs the question, if they're there to intimidate Ace, what are they trying to intimidate him from saying or not doing?
Well, that I can't tell you because I would never have expected Ace to all of a sudden break down in tears and confess whatever might have been his involvement. But if I were in their shoes and I didn't trust Ace, which wouldn't be a shocker, then... I would probably make sure I was around when the risk was there.
Okay. Bill, do you think it's possible that he had a role in the mix?
I don't get to deal in possibilities. I get to deal with real evidence and what I'm able with the rules to produce. But Joe was the first person we looked at. Ace, and whatever Mike says about Ace is probably true. He is the poster child for No Good Nick. He truly was. And we did everything we could, or we checked every way we could to see if he was connected, and we found truly no connection.
You know, one of the questions that I keep getting emails from people all over the world about is, what was his alibi? How do we know that he wasn't there at the scene, that sort of thing? I thought you probably would.
Transportation, for one thing, and he didn't have a way to get there. He didn't have a way to get to Rock Island or to Davenport from Rock Island. Primarily, that was it. And as Mike says, you know, that's his daughter. He's in the same household with her. But once she leaves, we don't have any connection. We have Joe riding around on a bicycle for a while and then riding around in someone else's car, supposedly looking for her. And Mike was...
He couldn't have gotten a ride to this location not that far from his home.
Yeah, with a little girl on fire? Or a little girl? I mean, I don't...
I'm saying before the girl went on fire.
So we're all able to speculate that there's another possibility, but we have.
Well, I'm just saying there's no alibi for Joe Glenn.
Yes, there is.
And it's a short distance from his home to where his stepchild was murdered.
No, that's not true. There is a Mississippi River in between the two.
There's
several miles.
We don't know where she was killed. In fact, that was one of the...
That was a proof problem.
Yeah, proof problem, and actually a statutory and constitutional issue that was raised, the jurisdictional mystery, so to speak.
No, I understand jurisdictional mysteries. I mean, you know, I've been doing crime reporting and crime writing for 25 years, and I understand many times, actually, people deliberately put a body in a different state or a different county so that it does create a jurisdictional quagmire so that the crime is more difficult to solve. And I mean, I'm sure you guys have encountered that more than once in your careers. My concern or my interest in this alibi question, to answer Scott's question, my interest in about this alibi, it comes directly from what the appellant brief says, which was filed, you know, in Scott County, and this appeal particularly refers to the travel times between the scene of the fire and Glenn's house, and Joe Glenn's house, apparently, a Davenport police officer testified in that 1995 jury trial that he timed the drive from the scene of the fire to the Glenn house. And it took 6 minutes and 8 seconds. That's not a very long drive. I mean, there may be a river there, but via car, 6 minutes and 8 seconds, and if the rate was slightly faster, that's just at legal speeds, it was also only going to take 5 minutes and 8 seconds. So basically a 5 or 6 minute drive, if you want to drive real perfectly with the speed limit, a 7 minute drive, it is not a big leap to think that he could have gotten a ride there and back with somebody, if in fact, as you are kind of insinuating, that he might have had two biker friends who could have been partners in this. I mean, I know it's speculation, but...
Exactly, and we deal in evidence and facts. We don't deal in speculation. I know you're quoting an appellate brief as factual. It's not. It's an argument.
But isn't it true, sir, that the drive between those two locations was timed out?
Yes, it was. And we put that into evidence.
6 minutes, 8 seconds?
Something to that effect, yes. It's not a great...
I'm just asking because I've done drives like that to try to understand whether or not a defendant would be guilty or innocent. I've actually taken the drives myself along the way in my own investigation. So when that's something that's quoted in an appellate brief, to me, that's not a question. That's a statement of fact.
Well, there's no argument about the short period of time that it takes for the drive. Of course, that doesn't add in the placement of the body as well as the dousing and igniting. The other thing is that the corroboration of Ace was extraordinarily vigorous from Mother. And
we're supposed to believe a mother? I mean, I'm just curious about, you know, a mother being the alibi for her ne'er-do-well son.
No,
you didn't read the whole transcript.
This is her stepfather. This is her husband, not her son.
Oh, you're talking about Sherry Glenn.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well,
stepfather, not the father.
Right. He was the stepfather. Yes. Sherry Glenn did a lot to try to give him an alibi. I know that. Right. In fact, the other question I have is that there was a witness who saw on television funeral footage of Joe Glenn wearing a long fringe black leather jacket, as I'm sure you're well aware, long fringe black leather jacket with tassels that had some kind of silver studs on it. And a witness later called in about that footage. And in fact, it was interesting that in the rebuttal in the 1995 retrial, both Joe and Sherry offered testimony to show that Joe had pawned this black leather jacket with the long fringes, and that it was in pawn until February of 1991, so that in the time period, with which this crime happened, he couldn't have possibly been wearing that jacket, and he couldn't have possibly, even at the funeral, been wearing that jacket. But
it didn't turn out to be provable either that he did pawn it.
It's not provable that he pawned it, because there was no pawn slip. It was just a corroborating testimony from someone else.
I'm going to cut in here just to give some context really quick, that this witness that Aphrodite is referring to is a woman named Roberta Cadera, who testified that on the night of Jennifer Lewis's murder, she was driving by Jefferson Elementary School. She says she saw a man with long hair wearing a leather jacket running from a fire into some nearby woods. She said the leather jacket had tassels and silver studs. And this testimony launched a contentious courtroom debate over whether the stepfather, Joseph Ace Glenn, had a leather jacket in his possession.
Obviously, Sherry Glenn, the mother, doesn't want to believe that her husband would have killed his stepdaughter. But and of course she'll do anything to defend her husband in the face of a possible allegation of murder. But why would she go to so much trouble to say that this man did not have and was not wearing this black fringed leather jacket, when in fact the funeral footage was pulled from the news, and he was in fact wearing not only a black fringed jacket, but it had the silver metal studs on it that the woman had seen and claimed that this is the same jacket that somehow Glenn was wearing at the time. So I don't understand that.
You get to the bottom of a trial or the end of a trial, and there's lots of things that you don't understand. These people don't deal in deep logic. And you talk about taking the body from one jurisdiction to another to make it more complicated. You don't know these people.
You don't think they did that? Anyone did that?
I don't think these people are intellectually able.
Uh-huh. Well, I you know them better than I do.
Unfortunately, and as Mike's...
I agree with Bill that I don't think that Sherry would have participated, of course, but I don't think that Ace would know anything about jurisdiction and why it might be handy other than just some basic short distance.
I guess one of the questions, this bothers me a little bit, and, you know, I've been a reporter for 30 years and I've done a lot of different things, but this still bothers me. I know you never have saints testifying in criminal cases, or rarely have saints testifying. But two of the critical people in this case have changed their story a little bit in the years since. I mean, we have the fellow who was a cellmate of Stanley Liggins. He now says that he was pushed to testify with a threat of being charged with accessory to murder after the fact. That's what he's saying now. You said that that is absolutely positively false.
I'm not saying he didn't say that to you, but
yes.
I know he knows the law as well as you do, and he knows there is no charge that he said he's threatened with.
Okay. So what I'm hearing from you from our earlier talk is he was never threatened with anything like that.
Well, No, I don't believe he was. And I think he would have told me if indeed there was that. That's just me thinking that. But I have absolutely no knowledge of anything like that occurring. And this Frank Rising is not the easiest guy in the world to get along with. And he speaks his mind. Ask Mike.
Yeah. I mean, I've interviewed Frank in person, and he's an intimidating individual. I mean, he's somebody who freely talks about having stabbed people in prison and done bad things. I mean, I guess, but what bothers me about it is you have somebody here who you're saying is not being truthful about why he testified. And when you have somebody like that who's maybe lying now or was lying, how do you know he wasn't lying then? I mean, it's like, personal integrity is what you come to.
Oh, really? And Mike, didn't you tell the jury about how many felonies he'd been convicted of and why they should doubt his veracity?
Yeah, I did. He was pretty well raped over on cross-examination, but in my experience, and I think Bill would agree with me, it's amazing how rarely that really affects a jury's belief of a snitch. It's disturbing how easily they adopt the testimony of snitches. But I was able to work him over pretty well, and even got him a little bit angry and showed his colors, so to speak, a little bit. But it just had no impact. He is the kind of person who would do anything if it would benefit him. There's no doubt about that. But I don't believe that he could be intimidated if there were other charges potential that had nothing to do with the Liggins case, of course, that he could have suffered from.
But he wasn't promised anything, this snitch, right?
Well,
that's what he says.
Well, when I interviewed him this time around, he gave an indication, maybe not a full statement, but an indication that maybe he got sent to a nicer prison.
But there was never any proof of that.
No, just him telling me that a few weeks ago.
Fact, by the way, that would have been after. I can tell you the other thing is that, it's not Bill style to do this, so it wouldn't have been offered by Bill, but the talk around among defense lawyers who later ended up representing him was that he claimed he had a pass on some stuff.
So in other words, he had an incentive that was not written and was understood, wink, wink, to testify?
Wink. I'm the only one in this jurisdiction who had the authority to give him a pass or to give him any future break as long as in this jurisdiction. And I can't believe he thought he was getting a pass for Illinois or across the state of Iowa, and I didn't give it to him.
Okay, fair enough.
Right. I hope that was clear from the preface of what I said.
So there's nothing, Bill, would it be fair to say there's nothing to his assertion or his hint that he might have gotten sent to a nicer facility because of his testimony against Stanley Liggins?
You know, I can't say that's absolutely true. I don't know. Okay. I mean, where he went after that? I have no idea.
He went to Rockwell City rather than Fort Madison.
Okay, but that's up to the Department of Corrections. So, and believe me, Michael, from his days as a prosecutor, will tell you, they hang up on us when we call them and ask them or tell them what we want them to do.
Okay, so nothing to that.
No, Corrections runs their own show.
Okay.
Well, you know, as we talk about this, I want to make it clear that what I think, Scott, and you know I think this because of the way I've talked about the police reports that I didn't get and some other things, possibly compensated witness for this case, but frequently compensated for many things that I have felt that officers did things that made a difference that had nothing to do with Bill and that Bill didn't know about. And that happens. And that is my great overview of the case, frankly, is that the Bill put on an honest prosecution, but he probably was not always given the honest information to work with.
Aphrodite, have you run across, you've been covering crime for a long, long time.
25 years.
25 years, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Have you run across those sort of things, the assertion that Mike's making in any cases you've covered? That the police were withholding evidence and they were doing some things, had a paid police informant who was testifying, but they never disclosed that, those sort of things. I mean, have you run across that?
I've run across that all the time. I mean, that's something that we see in many, many wrongful conviction cases. And frankly, I mean, it's oftentimes trials, as I see them, are like a game of chess. And with all due respect to any prosecutor, the objective is to win. And especially in a high-profile case such as this, where a little girl was burned and murdered, the pressure from the public to solve it, as you well have noted before, is great, tremendous. And in any case, any criminal case where there's a murder, there is a need on the part of the prosecution to win that case, to put somebody behind bars. And if, in fact, there's evidence that is exculpatory, that doesn't have to be handed over, or somehow isn't handed over, certainly I've seen that in other cases before. And usually that comes out when there are appeals and new trials granted. And that's when suddenly evidence that hadn't been seen before starts to appear. And I know in this case, as I recall, early on, back in the early 90s, there was no signing for evidence, signing for discovery. And so perhaps some reports and depositions, transcripts were not given to the defense. That allegation has been made and I think substantiated that there were 78 reports that were later found that had been not handed over to the defense. Whether or not that was a mistake, an accident, or in fact an effort on the part of prosecution, whether it not be the DA but somebody working within that office, it's not uncommon, certainly not uncommon. I've seen it many times.
We work in a small office. And we had an open file policy. Defense could come in at any time, and often did, and review what I have. They were supposed to get a copy of everything we had. And after
but
that,
they didn't,
just
right?
Can you? No, wait a minute. There was a finding that they didn't. And I'll accept that as a finding. But everything in my office went to the defense. Now, what I'm going to say is that has been changed. It was too loose a policy. Because of the small prosecution, we knew the defense lawyers, they knew us. Now every piece of paper is signed for so that we know. And that's been corrected because of this case. But I never hit a file in my life.
You know, see, the reason that you hear me speak in defense of Bill is that I think we're very close. And I guess, number one, I don't think Bill would do that. Number two, I especially don't think he would do it to me. And that's, I've done many cases, I don't know how many murder trials we've done together against each other. And I've never had that kind of thing happen.
Well, I'm only going by what has been reported. And what's been reported is that there were 78 alleged police reports containing exculpatory evidence, 78 police reports that were not given to the defense. And that's an awful large number of police reports to not be given to the defense, whether it was because they didn't come into the office to look at them, whether it was because there was this open system where nobody had to sign for anything. I don't know why this happened, but it did happen, according to everything that's been reported on this case. Am I wrong?
I believe that's true. I know it's true. I never saw them. I didn't know about them, actually, until the appellate decision, the last one, came out, to tell you the truth.
You know, 78 is a big number. But how many boxes did you get, Mike? The file was humongous.
Oh, yeah, it was a good foot tall.
So I guess what I'm hearing from Mike is he's not saying that the prosecution hid the reports. He thinks that the police may have hid the reports from the prosecution and the defense. Is that what I'm hearing from you, Mike?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what I think.
So are you saying that the police were withholding these reports from the DA on purpose?
Yeah. Yes. I can guarantee you there have been police officers in the Davenport Police Department who did things to benefit Bill's cases that he never asked them to do. He never necessarily had a reason to know what they had done.
But what would be the motivation of police to hide these reports from the DA? Because they were looking to solve the case with tunnel vision? That's the only thing I can think.
Yeah. Well, you can look at it that way. They extracted weak areas, things that would help the defense. Police officers do that.
Let me ask you this, Bill. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that the jury's never going to hear in this case. And, you know, they're never going to hear that unless Stanley happens to take the stand and they can impeach him. They're never going to hear that he served time in Mississippi for armed robbery. They're never going to hear that a month before Jennifer disappeared that he was arrested for sexually abusing another 9-year-old girl. They're never going to hear that he was acquitted for murder in the stabbing of another inmate in prison. They're not going to hear a lot of things about his background. Does that bother you at all?
No, not at all. He should be convicted on the evidence, not because he's a no good Nick.
Okay. So I guess what I get from a lot of people who have listened to this podcast and email me is, well, why are we even talking about this case? It sounds like he's just a really no good guy, and he's done a lot of bad things, and you know, and it's like, well, Mike, would you fill in there?
Well, I represented an awful lot of people that not only would I not have them home to dinner, I wouldn't even allow them to cross the sidewalk into my yard without holding a .45 auto in my hand.
I think the answer to the question as to why people are so interested in this and why we are focusing and looking at this case is because there is not one shred of evidence linking Mr. Liggins to Jennifer's murder. And, you know, there were thousands of comparisons of hairs and fibers taken from his car, his room, nothing in his Peugeot, nothing in his motel room was determined by a criminalist to have any trace that could have come from Jennifer or her clothing. And, you know, this conviction basically links Mr. Liggins to a crime because I guess somebody identified him from a mugshot photo.
No, they identified a taillight from the scene I think what you're referring to.
Well, no, I'm looking at after seeing a mugshot photo of Mr. Liggins and news stories about the investigation, it was Antonio Holmes police. And he identified through a photo, a mugshot, he identified this one Stanley Liggins. So it was after it had been on the news, and this person came forward. Other than that alleged eyewitness testimony that he saw Mr. Liggins standing outside the liquor store the evening of September 17th, and he picked Liggins out of a photo lineup. There's nothing else linking Liggins to this murder. And in fact, this Antonio Holmes later, who was intoxicated, later came back and said that he had been intoxicated and he couldn't even be sure that it was Mr. Liggins that he saw outside the liquor store. So I just think the strand that the police are hanging on to convict and hold accountable for murder this Stanley Liggins is very weak, very weak.
Well, let's let Bill respond. I can tell he's about to jump out of his seat wanting to respond here.
Well, the case isn't as familiar to me as it would have been years ago either. So, Mike, but are you forgetting about the two women sitting on their porch, seeing Stanley in that red Peugeot and having this little girl walk up and talk to him for a little bit? Are you forgetting that one?
I had forgotten about that. There were two women who did testify.
Very credible women.
There was no reason to think they would make something up. But at least connected them to the extent that they believed that they saw Jennifer talk to Stanley in the car. Now, obviously, that's not necessarily evidence of guilty behavior. It's evidence of the fact that they apparently knew each other or were at least in each other's general presence after she left the house.
At the end of the day, what does that prove? He was the last person to be seen with her in public?
That's all it proves.
It's a circumstantial case.
I understand. It's
okay,
circumstantial,
so all
I'm
of
saying,
it, you have to weigh it all. If you take any one piece of it, it means nothing.
But what other pieces are there, sir?
Well, I tried this case twice. I don't know. What did it take us, Mike? A week or two, 10 days right. or something? Mike wouldn't have lost a case if that's all I had.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But you also had the testimony from the woman who said she saw taillights.
And we also had the woman who saw the gas can in the back seat of the Peugeot.
Yeah, of course, I always figured that was BS because I have a gas can in the trunk of my car right now. And the argument about him spraying it at a car wash to get all of the trace evidence as well as any gasoline residue out of there was also BS because there was no evidence that there was residue of commercial detergent in the vehicle.
Let me ask you this, Bill. Both Mike and Julie Walton trained under you, and in a lot of jurisdictions, I mean, I know this from covering it, and I've heard this from a lot of experienced defense attorneys. When a case like this comes up after 26, 27 years, and you have to do a retrial, a lot of places they'll end up pleading out for time served or something like that. That's not happening here. And what do you think their motivations are? Do you think what drives them?
First of all, I don't think Stanley will take a plea.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't. But what's the benefit to the state, to the people? He would be time served and loose.
Yeah.
They could just decide not to retry it then, whatever, if that's your goal in life.
Yeah.
What I'm hearing from you is you think they're driven by the desire to protect the community.
No, all of you folks keep saying driven.
Okay.
You try the cases that come in and that you think that you can prove to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. There was no pressure on me, and I don't believe there's any pressure, especially less now, or pressure on Mike and Julie to be trying the case. I don't see the community pressure. I don't see a whole lot of community interest.
I guess maybe driven wasn't the right word, but what compels them is a desire for justice in this case. Is that
it's doing your job.
It's doing your job. Okay. Aphrodite, what else comes to mind?
Well, I mean, you know, first and foremost, let me say that, you know, while there is no forensic evidence to tie this man to this crime, you know, one of the things you've all talked about here is the CSI effect and the fact that juries want to have forensic evidence nowadays to tie a defendant to a crime, especially a heinous crime like this. What concerns me is if this man, this violent man, as he's given a third trial, is found to be not guilty by a jury, if someone has a doubt on a jury, and of course we don't know if he's going to take a bench trial or opt for a bench trial or opt for a jury trial, if he pleads to the bench, you know, I think that with two convictions already there, my feeling would be that a judge is going to be less likely to let him out into this society, but, you know, who knows? But I think a jury could easily have somebody on it who would have a doubt, especially when they're unable to hear about his prior convictions, that he, is basically a convicted felon walking the streets and a danger to society. And under any circumstances, under no circumstances, do we want someone like that walking around on the streets? However, does it mean that he committed this particular crime? And because there is only circumstantial evidence, which I realize many cases are just circumstantial, but there is nothing physical to tie him to this crime, he could wind up walking the streets again. And I think that on the one hand, that is mortifying if he did this. That is mortifying. On the other hand, if he did not do this, and there's a possibility that there's someone out there who got away with murder who can't be found right now, then, you know, we have a travesty of justice. So, I think that's the thing that keeps us all in suspense about this case, and the thing that people want to get to the bottom of. People want to get to the truth. And the truth is, this man claims he didn't do it. He may be the worst man on the face of the earth. He's certainly a child molester. He's certainly an acquitted murderer. And yet, do we know that he committed this particular murder, this crime? And while it was two different juries that convicted him, my understanding is that there was a bias on these juries, that there, one jury had a South African person who was a white supremacist and his wife also on the jury. I don't know. These were all white juries back in time who were hearing about a black man who had a record who allegedly murdered and burned alive, burned this girl.
A white girl.
You said with a record. They didn't know that.
But yeah, they did hear about this his alleged drug dealing with.
No, they didn't.
No, in the first trial. That was
okay,
why
and it was reversed. They did not hear it in the second one.
Okay, fair enough.
There had been a motion to suppress, and the judge didn't rule that out. And I was foolish enough to think that the appellate court would agree with him. But they didn't.
Okay.
When you keep saying circumstantial evidence, under Iowa law, and I think Illinois too, I've done a few over here, circumstantial evidence is evidence. They weigh
under
the
every
evidence.
Law, in every state.
Oh, no, wait a minute. Years ago, when you and I started this business, there used to be a special instruction on just circumstantial evidence. There isn't any longer. It is just evidence.
Let me ask you this, Aphrodite. Since we're talking about jurors, we're talking about verdicts, and we're talking about evidence, and you've looked at all this evidence that's been presented in the last two trials, if you were sitting on that jury, how do you think you would vote?
Well, I think that the reason I bring up this stepfather nicknamed Ace is that I would have a doubt in my mind about his role, participation, and or having done this deed. And the reason I say that is not just because of the leather coat or because he seemed to protest too much about that, but because, more importantly, there were neighbors, and in particular, this man, Arnold Pappas, who later testified and described a statement that this man made, saying that, you know, Joe Glenn got out in the middle of the street and was standing and screaming, and if I'm going to quote it, "You punk-ass motherfuckers don't mean nothing to me. He said that I killed my daughter, and you punks don't mean shit to me. I can kill you, too." And that's a quote. So to me, if I'm going to hear that in a trial and I'm going to start to think a stepfather who may or may not have liked the attention that his wife was giving to this child that was not really his, a man who's a ne'er-do-well of his own accord, not necessarily a criminal but a druggie, that raises a doubt in my mind as to whether or not this person did have something to do with it. And
now, understand, no jury has ever heard about that incident with the neighbor.
But will it be brought into court?
It came up in a post-conviction hearing.
Yeah,
but I would assume that the jury that we're going to have coming up will hear about this case. I mean, I'd be shocked if that isn't brought up by the defense.
Well, it's got to be a big thing by the defense. That's a huge thing. And it was two people who heard it. It was Arnold Pappas and another woman by the name of Ms. Gomez.
Right.
So it wasn't.
Did not deny saying that, or in his recollection, it was something like that.
But Lori Gomez and Arnold Pappas are credible witnesses, and if he didn't deny that he stood in the middle of the street on April 7th, 1999, and shout, "I killed my daughter," that brings, for me as a juror, if I were a juror, a huge sense of doubt as to whether or not Stanley Liggins is the man.
Bill, you've mentioned to me before that Ace had a tendency to say really stupid things. I mean, is that a...
That's an understatement. Truly an understatement.
I mean, you said he was an extraordinarily frustrating witness to work with.
Oh, he was terrible.
Why don't you elaborate a little bit?
No, I'm not going to, because I'm not, you know, this case has got to be tried over. Uh-huh. Prosecutors aren't real happy that I'm here anyway, and I'm not going to go on the air and tell the defense how to try their case.
Okay. Fair enough. Well, let me ask this question of both Mike and Bill. Do you think we'll see justice done in this case of the upcoming trial?
I believe that there's nothing like an American jury to shake out the truth and justice. And I don't know of any reason why it won't happen in this case.
How about you, Mike?
And my answer would be, I don't know.
Do you have a thought?
I don't know.
Do you have a thought, Aphrodite?
I think that the outcome of the trial has to play itself out. And, you know, there's no doubt that this is a dangerous man. And that, having said that, Stanley Liggins, having been convicted twice, there has to be something there to make two jurors not just sit here and say, oh, well, they're white supremacists and they're anti-black and they just wanted to pin it on somebody. No, there has to be something there more than one circumstance to have led these juries to convict him. So, you know, we're going to have to let it play out. I can't see it any other way. I do have a question in my mind about the possibility that this Joe Glenn might have had some connection to it. My other question is, why is Joe Glenn, I know he's perhaps a homeless man, I don't think he's dead, why is he not coming out of the woodwork with this podcast and screaming, you know, his innocence to the mountaintops? Why has he disappeared and nowhere to be found?
I don't think Joe's the kind of guy that listens to public radio.
But, you know, I mean, Scott went down to New Orleans to go try to find this man. And, you know, he actually questioned a bunch of people who thought they recognized him. He now has a beard, whatever, doesn't have a beard. I mean, he has to know from the streets that somebody's looking for him. And if he's so innocent, why doesn't he step forward to profess it? It's just a question. I'm not saying, you know, anything's provable, but it's just a huge question in my mind. And to answer your question, Scott, as to what might happen, if I had that question as just an observer, then sitting in the trial could be a juror who's going to have that question.
Absolutely, I appreciate that. One thing, point I really want to make is this man had the most competent counsel in this area as defense lawyers in two trials. It wasn't that, he got, quote, the bottom lawyer or the new kid on the block. He got competent, experienced counsel and excellent representation.
No, I don't doubt it for a minute. And I'm sure that I don't think the case is being argued on the merits of counsel, is it? I mean, the appeal.
Good point.
No,
lawyers don't win
and the fact
cases.
Is,
facts
is,
do.
I do have to say that I think a lot of the success is to be laid at the feet of Bill as a trial lawyer. I did the best I could against a case that was troublesome.
Well, look, it's a miracle to get a conviction.
Stuff like that.
It's a miracle to get a conviction with such little evidence, and I applaud. I applaud you, Bill, for that tremendously. Do not take away anything from Bill Davis and what he's done here. And do I think that Stanley Liggins belongs on the streets? I absolutely do not. Is he a danger to society? In my opinion, he absolutely is. I am just questioning whether or not a jury is going to, in a third trial, why this man was given a third trial is curious. And a jury who's hearing this, with some new evidence, may a juror have a doubt. And hence, he may be let go.
You're absolutely right.
I think he has a better chance with this trial than with either of his first two.
Bill, I can tell you're about to jump out of your seat to say something, so go ahead.
General rule, the state's case gets better the second time or the third time around. I don't know that that'll be the case in this particular thing. As your expert pointed out, there are some things that a juror is going to pick up on, and if they're handled in such a way that it sticks out and jogs somebody's mind, there's a problem. This case is – there's all kinds of – issues. Most of the witnesses, if you get back to your office with all your fingers, you feel good. Crimes like this don't happen at the convent or on the church steps, and we don't have the Monsignor as a witness generally. You talk about the witnesses that we have available and how come their character is questionable, because that's where crimes happen. That's who sees crimes.
That's the world.
Aphrodite, you, as the listeners know, I was one of the first people on the scene that night back in 1990. I was a very young reporter. And, I can honestly say it's the most horrible thing I've ever seen in my life. You've worked a lot of different crimes over the years. And you said when we were chatting on the phone the other day that this crime reminds you of one that you wrote a book on. Why don't you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, well, that's one of the reasons I think I'm so pumped up about this, is because I wrote a book called Cruel Sacrifice. In 1992, a 12-year-old girl was beaten, raped, and sodomized with a tire iron for 9 hours in the trunk of a car, and then burned alive on a field in Indiana. And the murderers, the culprits, were three teenage girls. I was at their sentencing hearings. Two of the girls got 60 years. One got 50, the one who poured the gas on Shanda Scherer, the 12-year-old. In all, there were four teenage girls driving around in a car with a 12-year-old in the trunk for 9 hours. And two of those girls tortured her and beat her. The third girl helped with pouring the gasoline on her, and they burned her alive. The fourth girl actually turned state's evidence and got a 10-year sentence, a reduced sentence for her testimony. But really, all four girls were somehow a part of this horrible, brutal murder of a 12-year-old child. And unfortunately for me, as Scott had to witness this scene, I had to witness through photographs a child who she looked like a mannequin that somehow, when then you got close in on the face and it was just charred, and it was so horrific, and it is so horrific. And that book, Cruel Sacrifice, remains to this day, 20-something years later, kind of a cult book, because I go into the history of these girls and how it was they came to kill this 12-year-old, and how four teenage girls ages 15 and 16 could murder and burn alive a 12-year-old girl. And for what? And it turned out it was supposedly some lesbian love ring, and I don't know how a 12-year-old knows whether she's a lesbian or not, but I don't think this child really knew what she was involved in. Clearly didn't have, any life's experience, and that case haunts me forever. It's just that is the most horrifying crime I've ever heard of, and this one comes close. I mean, it's just senseless. It could be anyone's grandchild, anyone's child. And I think that in both cases, what strikes me is that the public at large doesn't even know about these girls or these types of cases. Not that they're an everyday case, by far not, but there are many cases of children who are brutally and savagely murdered, and we don't hear about it because they're not, a JonBenet Ramsey. They're not a wealthy kid that like a J.C. Dugard or a whatever, you know, that we do hear about. And I think it's vital that the public pay attention to what's happening to our children, and not just as victims, but also in the case of cruel sacrifice, children who are killing each other. And I know when I wrote that many years ago, I thought, oh, this is an anomaly. This will never, ever happen again. And you know, there's been more teen-on-teen violence in recent years than ever before. And
is there anything else you'd like to add, Mike, or Aphrodite, or Bill?
No, I'm fine. Thanks.
No, I really don't have anything to add. I think Bill knows this, and I bet you to you, Scott, that this is the case that cost me and my family the most pain in terms of how we were treated in the public and in social situations. It was a hard case to do.
I know, and your predecessor, Gary McKendrick, who was the defense attorney in the first trial, said it was the only case where he got death threats defending.
Yeah. Yeah. So. And then in my case, it was not just me, but my wife and daughter were ostracized from any number of summer activities during the trial and shunned and called names and all kinds of things.
Okay. Anything you'd like to add, Aphrodite, as we close out?
And just, you know, this little girl happens to share the same last name as my family's last name, Lewis, L-A-W-I-S. And I have to say that, you know, my feelings toward her, while I've never known her and I've only heard about her, is that she deserves the fight for justice. She deserves to know who her killer is, and she deserves the truth. And that is what I'm looking for here.
I think that's a very noble goal. I will say that. And I don't hate you like I hate Nancy Grace.
Well, that's good. I shouldn't be hated because I'm not trying to question the law. I'm on the law's side, frankly, in most of what I do.
Well, I'd like to try the case again myself, but
I'm tired.
Okay. Thank you guys for really being on here. I appreciate it.
Production support comes from Alfredo Monteca. Big thanks to Colin Thompson and Cast Media for our online presence. And thank you to WVIK CEO Jay Pierce and the WVIK staff. All archived audio was generously provided by WQAD-TV Channel 8.